Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by GoToMeeting. You know, like most of America, most of the world, you're probably traveling a lot this holiday season. And probably for many of us, well, the fourth quarter is a very busy time. And you need a tool that will help you conduct business even when you're not face-to-face with clients or colleagues. So I highly recommend online meetings with GoToMeeting. Collaborate on documents in real time, give engaging sales presentations by showing your desktop. And all it takes is a quick two-minute download of GoToMeeting. Start scheduling meetings in advance or on the fly, so your conference calls can be more productive and more efficient. Now, we use GoToMeeting and can't believe how easy it is to use and set up and the whole process. And my listeners can try GoToMeeting free for 45 days. That's over a month of online meetings for free. For this special offer, go to GoToMeeting.com, click the Try It Free button, and use the promo code PODCAST. That's GoToMeeting.com, promo code PODCAST, for this special 45-day trial. I think you'll really like it. And welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 189 for the Thanksgiving Day time period of the year, and we have a great guest with us today. We'll talk about a lot of things that are focusing on, for example, probably the bailouts that are going on, quantitative easing, and all those things that has everybody very concerned. But we have somebody today that you have written me a lot about. This is a person who I think has a great perspective and obviously, a working crystal ball, John Malden. And he's written many books. He also writes the newsletter Thoughts from the Frontline. And he joins us from Texas today. Hey, John, how are you?
I'm doing very, very good. And let me say, my crystal ball is working. Somebody's got it covered.
Oh. You don't want to see.
That may be it. You got to be very careful when you talk about working crystal balls.
Yeah, I hear you. So last time we talked back in April, actually, and we talked about the whole legacy we're going to leave our kids, and we were talking about the potential for big debt buildups and all this. Tell me just, you know, I have a lot of things to talk to you about, but tell me about what's your general thesis today, and more so, you know, of you know, what you're thinking about, but what's really happening?
Well, the I've just finished, literally, a book last Friday that'll come out in February called The Endgame. And the subtitle is The End of the Debt Supercycle and How It Affects Everything That We Do. Because ultimately what's happening is that even as businesses and individuals are beginning to now deleverage and rework their leverage, governments are going to be forced to do that as well. Now, the United States is the last in line, but eventually we're going to have to figure out how to get our debt down to under nominal GDP growth. And that's a significant different economic environment when everybody's trying to deleverage all at once throughout the developed world, necessarily, than what we've had before. What we've seen is that for 60, 70 years, that increase in leverage has been a big component of growth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, now it's not going to be there. And so we're going to have to create more organic growth. And and that's a different environment for nations and individuals. It's a healthier environment when we get to the end of it, but the process here over the next five, six, seven, 8 years, it's not going to be terribly fun. it's going to be a slower growth environment, more volatile, probably more frequent recessions, the employment numbers are going to be disappointing. As I pointed out 2 years ago, and it's even more so today, to get back to 2007
mm-hmm.
jobs numbers,
right,
we have to create roughly 300,000 jobs a month, every month, for 5 years. We've never done that for a quarter, you know, 3 months in a row, even during the boom times.
Yeah, that seems a little difficult.
So it's a very daunting, slow motion task, and as we are going to be forced to reduce our fiscal deficits, and forced to in one of two ways: either the voters say that's it, we've had all we can handle, which is kind of what they said last November here.
Yeah.
And we get some more of that, and so we start reducing that government deficit. Or the bond market at some point, sooner rather than later, or in the case of it, maybe it's later rather than sooner, but 3, 4, 5 years, the bond market simply says, guys, we no longer find you to be credible. We're going to run your rates up, and then we become Greece or Ireland, and we really do hit the wall.
So let me ask you this. I mean, it seems to me that what you're saying is this, putting it into a very, very succinct point, that it's much easier to eat during Thanksgiving, get fat through the end of the year and Christmas, than diet in January.
Correct.
took you a second to figure out what I was going after there, right?
the problem is, we've already eaten. It's already Thanksgiving
right.
and Christmas.
Right.
It's now January.
Right. And we don't want, and we don't want it to be January, and we're not acting like it's January.
The problem is what I show in the book, and I've shown in my letters, is that when you take just the basic economic equations and you start throwing them out to people and saying, here's what it is, when you reduce government spending,
yep.
in the short term, it's going to reduce GDP.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the Keynesians are right. Now, there's no multiplier effect when you have that Keynesian stimulus.
Right.
Okay, it's still government spending, but it is a stimulus of sorts, and it does have an effect on the economy in the short term. Now, the problem is we didn't run surpluses when we should have been running surpluses. So now we have a limited fiscal response that we can do. And that's going to, as we're going to find out painfully, it's going to limit growth. There's no question about it.
So this,
and,
this is going
we,
on.
But we have no choice, because if we don't, yeah. then we hit the wall. We become Greece.
No, they're in austerity mode over in Europe. And nobody seems to really, I mean, yes, we care and all that, but it's not the austerity necessarily that's hurting, because the austerity is such, it's only been implemented for, 4 months or so? And Greece, yes, hit the wall, and Ireland hit the wall, and who knows who's next, Portugal, Spain. But the thing is that it doesn't seem like right now anybody's talking about really, or anybody's really concerned about growth issues. As a matter of fact, they're talking about how the Eurozone is really powering ahead. But it just doesn't make any intellectual sense. And we're, by the way, we're short European shares. We're short the euro. So just to kind of put that in perspective, we believe that there's a tremendous problem over there, and it's much greater than just the fact that they have embedded bank problems and debt problems. We believe that the austerity measures are going to be a multiplier to the negative to them.
Well, I agree with you about the problems that the eurozone is going to have. I know that the bodies of the trading world, I mean, there are bodies all over the trading world that have been short the euro, the Japanese yen, for years.
Oh yeah.
But I think, and we make a strong case for in the book, that Japan is going to be the next really big out of left field surprise. that it's just everybody's going to look up and they're going to go, my God, how did this wreck happen?
You know, it's funny you mention that, John, because I've been looking at Japan for a while and saying, what is the attraction to Japanese debt, to Japanese currency? Traditionally, when you look at a currency that you want to buy, you know, when you do a carry trade or you want to, you know, you look for a currency that has a, you'd buy a currency with a higher rate and of country with a higher rate, and you'd sell the one with a lower rate, you know, or you look at current account surpluses and you look at all that. Japan doesn't have any of those things that go along with that, right? But yet the yen keeps on rising. And is it obviously because that is the last possible place that people think that they can get busted out of, because there's no way that the Japanese can bring down their debt load, and so they're saying that, you know, at this point they're not even going to bother, and the U.S. may actually try to hurt the dollar, because the yen is as a place to go to buy doesn't make any sense.
Well, the problem that the Japanese have is that they've taken the savings of the Japanese people for 20 years and they've turned it into government debt, which mm-hmm. is how they've been able to hold their rates down and get to, you know, 210% debt to GDP ratios. But their savings have gone from 16% in 1990 down to much less than 2% now. And as they have an aging society, literally dying, people are starting to take their retirement savings and do what they had planned to do, which is retire. They're yeah. spending that money. They're eating their seed corn that they'd saved all these years. Well, when that savings rate goes negative, that's when Japan will start to hit the wall, because I believe that the Japanese central bank will monetize the debt. And as they start monetizing the debt, there's a limit. You know, just how many yen can you put in the world? And I think the yen at that point goes back up to 100, then 125, then yep. 150, then 200. Because they either can reduce their deficit, fiscal deficit, by about the equivalent of 10% of GDP, which is monster.
Right.
You know, and would throw them, you know, into a recession. Mm-hmm. Not just a recession, a depression.
Yeah, all out.
Depression. Or they could print, which is going to be, you know, decrease the value of the yen. Which, quite frankly, most of the businesses and the exporters in Japan wouldn't mind seeing the yen.
Oh, they'd love that. Yeah, at least above 85, because it just can't get there, it seems.
And. You know, it's. I don't think people understand the problems that a yen at 150 and the heartache that the euro at parity will create for China.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the other nations in Asia.
Well, I think that's why China.
We're just at the beginning. It's kind of a kindergarten fight now. Right. The kids at the playground about currencies. Wait till it gets serious here in about 3 or 4 years.
I got to tell you, it's heating up pretty fast. I mean, we're seeing a lot of protectionism going on. We're seeing a lot of currency manipulation going on. Now, Geithner's saying that a strong dollar is in our best policy. You just got to throw that right out the window. Anything that obviously comes from his mouth after that point is just, you know, rhetoric and lip service. And you say, you know, now they're trying to change the name. The Fed no longer call it quantitative easing. They don't want, now quantitative easing has a bad name, just like printing money does, right? You have to change it again. But you seem kind of frustrated. Am I reading this wrong? You seem kind of frustrated with kind of the state of things right now.
Well, I don't like. I mean, as I wrote in my letter this last Friday, I don't think the $600 billion in QE is going to do all that much. So I'm not as worried as a lot of people who are saying, you know, this is going to create all sorts of disasters. I don't think $600 billion is really enough. I mean, if you really want to do something, you know, I start getting interested when you're talking $3 or $4 trillion. Now, that could start doing some damage.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if they keep the QE up, and so they're doing $600 billion every 6 months, now that becomes problematical. And I think the unintended consequences of dealing with, you know, economic theory, I mean, are just huge.
Yep. And this is all theory right
and,
now.
And you know, I think the economy is so big and that America is so resilient that we can probably absorb the stupidity of $600 billion. Okay?
Yep.
I don't think it's going to be a body blow. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
We can probably just, you know, shrug it off. But you can't, you know, at some point you got to stop.
Yeah.
Get a real handle on things.
So I know that maybe this is the time to just, we'll end it with this point and this question. You know, I know you've been involved with the Republican Party for a while, and I know down in Texas, I think that's a Republican state, right?
Pretty much.
Pretty much, yeah. So what do you think about this last election, and what do you think that it is going to do, if anything, moving forward? Not to mention, let's even put aside that who knows what's going to happen with any kind of repeal and talk about that. Let's put aside the fact that this lame duck, they're going to, you know, have to vote in some kind of tax extension or not on Bush's tax cuts. What do you think? Do you think this really has a chance to balance a little bit and to do something, or is this going to be just the same old with the Republicans saying no and the Democrats trying to, you know, do all sorts of things they can to spend, you know, all of the money available?
The Republican Party, if they're going to really change things, or if they're really going to do anything, has got to stop being the party of no, don't do that, and start becoming the policy of we want to replace that bad policy with this good policy. And here's what we want to replace it with, and here's the philosophical reasons, and this is why we think voters should look at this policy. And now, part of the reason, I mean, that they really haven't been in a position to do anything for 4 years, because, you know, nobody paid any attention to them. They had two or three good congressional leaders, there's some good senators, and they'd, you know, propose something, and the House leadership or the Senate leadership would just kind of laugh and say, "Go away, little boys, leave us alone."
Right.
You know, this is our game.
Right.
Well, now at least in Congress, they're going to have to put forth serious ideas, and we're going to have a free for all in the presidential primary on the Republican side, and people are looking, I think, for somebody that can act as an adult, can explain things, can articulate positions, and that looks presidential. I was on the state executive committee for the Republican Party here in Texas,
mm-hmm,
for most of the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Fairly serious level of political involvement. And then I sold my business in 1999, 2000, and had to go back to work for a living, and I kind of more or less dropped out of politics, and, you know, glad don't miss it. But but I have some understanding of that world. And I think we're going to have the most interesting presidential year that we've ever had, because it's literally wide open. You can't get me a front runner.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've been listening lately to Newt Gingrich.
Yeah, no, heard. I've definitely noticed that his name has been popping up a bit more, and there's some discussion there.
Go look at some of his proposals and listen to some of his speeches. He is going to be a formidable mind in the debates.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there's any doubt but that he's planning to run.
Right.
Can he win? I don't know. Should he win? I have no idea. But I think when you get guys like him, and then you see two or three of the governors that are beginning to, Mitch Daniels out of Indiana, they're starting to produce serious position papers.
Yep.
And I think the debate that the country is going to have as they watch the Republicans go through this is going to be quite fascinating.
Yeah.
because we really do have to have a policy that we can take to the American people and say, this is what we want to replace these ideas with. It's not just it's not enough to say that's a bad idea. We have to have some good ideas. And it's not enough to say, well, we want to run stop running such big deficits. We've got to have ideas that say, how are we going to do that? Because you can't just cut, spending on discretionary items. I get you $100 billion or so.
Yeah.
It's a good start. But the reality is we're going to have to restructure our tax policies. We're going to have to restructure Medicare, Social Security. I'm just assuming we can get that done because that's kind of an easy fix. But Medicare is a conversation that we as a country have yet to have as an adult. Because we say, you know, we want to cut spending, but then we don't want to cut the part of Medicare that helps us.
Right. Cut
this other guy's benefits. Well, that doesn't work. We are either going to have to create a VAT.
Mm-hmm.
We can reform Medicare all we want. If we even take Ryan's and everybody's, let's just assume their Republican ideas can get enacted.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a big assumption.
Right.
Okay. Still doesn't pay for it. Still doesn't pay for it.
Right.
I mean, if we either have to start rationing health care, which evidently nobody in this country wants to do,
right.
Or we're going to have to just, some people aren't going to get covered. Or if we want something where the majority of people, you know, get covered of some kind,
mm-hmm.
it's going to cost money. And we've got to figure out, you know, who's going to pay for it and how we're going to do it.
Yeah, I mean, in the end.
And that's not an easy equation.
Right.
And Republicans aren't ready to do that yet. They still keep thinking, I mean, this is what I was writing a few weeks ago, before the election. I mean, they're arguing two ideas that are incompatible. One, we're not going to cut Medicare. Two, we're not going to raise taxes.
Right.
No, guys, you can't have both.
Right.
You just can't have both.
Right.
I mean, you know, I don't know if a responsible discussion will be able to be had because people just don't want to hear it. I mean, they want to. They don't mind somebody saying, you know, we think that you should go on a diet, eat eat more salads, lots of proteins, stop all the junk food. But they end up voting for the guys that tell them they can spend one more year on the couch eating hamburgers.
it's like simply the idea of the diet and the whole thought process of being thin and on all this great stuff and climbing mountains and riding bicycles is great. But then you're like, I'll do it Monday. And Monday comes around and you're like, oh my, I don't want to do that. You know? And so I think that the whole point is that I agree with you that there needs to be something to be done. It would be very nice if we could take the politics, the true BS rhetoric, propaganda style politics, which are rampant today, which have always been there, but they seem to be even bigger today on a global basis, and put it all aside to try to fix things. But I just don't know if that's going to happen because nobody wants to deal with it. And I agree with you. And I know you have a time limit, so I'm kind of cutting us short here.
I think, for instance, and I was pleasantly shocked that the president's deficit commission.
Mm-hmm.
When the chairman released their first draft and everybody said, it's a non-starter, we can't do that, I was kind of impressed that, A, it got shut down from both sides,
yeah,
which is always a good thing, but, B, when you start actually looking at it, I don't think a top rate of 23% is anything that Republicans should sniff at. They're going to capitalize capital gains and tax capital gains and dividends at the same rate. But 23% is not that bad.
Yep.
But also what they had in there, as you go through it, they say, hey, you want to keep some of your goodies here? Here's what taxes have to go up to keep your goodies. If you want to keep your mortgage deduction, everybody pays 4% more.
Right.
And you start going, well, really, 4%? Is that what a mortgage deduction cost everybody?
Mm.
Well, 40% of the people in America don't have homes. Half the people that do have homes, or more than half, got them paid for, or they're only getting a little bit of deduction. And they'd be better off paying 4% less and not having that interest rate deduction.
Right, especially because they don't itemize. A lot of people don't itemize either, and you don't get it there either.
Yeah, so, I mean, if you want to keep your child tax credits and other things like that, that costs you 1%. And I think something laid out like that says, here's where we just take all of these, what they call tax expenditures, we're going to take them all off the table. And if you want them back, here's what it costs you.
Right. It's a left side, right side, give and take. You can't have both. You have to balance it, which is obviously, you know, between two rational people talking about it, it makes all the sense in the world. But when you have in the back that you, I think that you can, you know, spend unlimited amounts of money in the back end and bury things into all sorts of different types of either expenditures or budget items, I don't think they care. It's all about getting elected, isn't it?
It is, but I think that the American people are, instinctively we're a center-right country, and the bureaucrats are center-left.
Yeah.
I think more and more Americans are recognizing the fact that there's a limit.
Yep.
And it's not that they're against Obamacare or they're against this. They're scared. They're scared that the country they grew up in is not going to be the country they want to live in. What do you do when interest rates go back up to 12% and growth is at 2% and we see stagflation?
Yep.
And that's exactly what could happen if we don't get these fiscal deficits under control.
I hear you.
Well, you start paying 12% for your short-term debt.
Yep.
We in the United States, there's a technical economic term. It's called screwed.
Yeah. You know, somebody came up with comment. I wrote about stagflation in my last quarterly letter that I put out, and that if you look at really what's going on right now, even though the CPI numbers don't come out, the PPI numbers don't come out showing inflation, there is a stagflation concept that is really building here. High unemployment, low growth, and higher cost of items. I mean, there's nothing.
Look at my letter last week. What I pointed out was that if you take out homeowner equivalent rents out of the equation, inflation's at 1.9%.
Right.
Okay. If you had used housing prices as your measure and not homeowner equivalent rents, we would have never had a bubble.
Right.
Because the Fed would have been leaning into inflation in 2002, 2003. They would have been raising rates rather than dropping them.
Mm-hmm. Because the housing prices were going up so nicely.
Right.
Yep.
But they didn't want to see an asset price as part of their inflation. But asset prices do in fact make a difference.
Well, they didn't use all the latest information. They didn't realize, I think, that people would have, you know, with the HELOC. Years ago there weren't HELOCs. So they didn't realize that people were gonna use as ATMs, and that's where the adjustment should have been made. That the money flow, the monetary base in the country was so much more extended because not only the housing values went out, but there was a way now to unlock the value. 20 years
right.
ago, who thought of a HELOC and who thought of unlocking the value of your home? You paid off your mortgage, you were done.
Well, and that all goes back to the deleveraging process that mm-hmm. we, you know, when we started the end game.
Right, exactly.
And now that we're in the process of deleveraging and restructuring, you know, and recognizing, gee, well, maybe a home isn't an ATM. You know, maybe a home isn't an investment. Maybe we, you know, need to think through this process as we do deleverage.
Yep.
It's a completely different world.
I hear you.
And that's a different type of growth dynamic for companies and for businesses that you know are going to be looking at consumers. I mean, you just got to rethink what you're doing.
Yep, I hear you. Well, John, I know let's cut it here. I know you got lots of things to do. We have Thoughts from the Frontline, John Malden, lots of books out, and the new book coming out in February called
The End Game.
We'll have you on before that to kind of get it going. Hopefully I can read a copy of that beforehand so I can get on with that. John Malden, check out his website at johnmalden.com, MALDIN.com.
Right. And we'll be sure to the weekly letter's free, so, you know, your listeners can go to that website and become one of my 1.5 million closest friends.
Yeah, that would be nice. That would be very nice. And I will make sure to put that on the website as well, link to that, and we'll have it up soon. John Malden, thanks for joining me on the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
Thank you.
All right, bye-bye, buddy.
Bye-bye.
I encourage you to check out all the things that he writes because he's just one of those guys that really does a great job at putting down not only what's happening now, but as I mentioned in the beginning of that interview, he has a bit of a crystal ball, it seems. Sometimes maybe it's foggy, but right now and lately, he seems to be right on. What I wanted to talk about was, I guess, all about Europe for a second. I want to kind of refocus on that. And I'll also bring to your attention that next week, we have our old friend Das coming on, who is an expert in CDS and debt exposure and really has an in-depth understanding of the markets when it comes to debt issues in particular. And we're going to talk to him about, in particular, Europe, because I have a lot of questions to ask him about what's going on. But I do want to talk to you a little bit about what I see right now. You know, we had, taking it back a bit, we had the concern that Greece, of course, was going to be a big issue, and it turned out to be so. But as I've mentioned time and time again, of course, the powers that be, whether it's the prime minister, whether it's depending on the country, the person in charge of the financial markets, so that would be possibly the, like what we have is either Bernanke or Geithner, or in Greece they have the finance ministers and they have, of course, Sarkozy when it comes to the ECB. When it comes to what they say, I think we've gotten to a point that we need to step back and ask some questions and not just rely on their commentary, particularly those that come from individual countries. Let me tell you why. Remember that story way back when that you were told? It was entitled The Boy Who Cried Wolf. I think it was called Peter or something and The Boy Who Cried Wolf. And the story was all about this little boy who wanted attention. And the little boy wanted attention. And basically what would happen was that he would be in a field and say, oh, there's a wolf, help. And people would come in to rescue him. This is the general story. You'll get the gist and you know this. That, oh my gosh, we're going to save you. And there was no wolf. And then again, the next night or 2 nights later, oh, again, there's a wolf. We have, you know, no wolf. So eventually, after a few times, there was a realization by the townspeople, the parents, you know what? He's just doing this for attention. There's really nothing that we can do for him. And we're not going to answer. Now, one night, of course, you know what happens. A real wolf appears. And he cries, wolf, and what happens? Nobody shows up. They think that, you know, what he said before was a big lie. Why do we trust him now? You know what? We're not being fooled again. This is just enough. No, but really, there's a wolf here. Nope, we're not believing him. Well, the end of the story wasn't so good when the wolf did its damage. And now what we're seeing is a similar process happening. Because as we saw the possibility of a Greek bailout necessary, when in Greece, all they were saying was, no, this isn't going to happen. We're going to reach our numbers. And then they did get a bailout. When they came back and said that our budgets are going to be aligned in such a way that now we are going to definitely have no problem reaching our budget numbers so that we could pay off the debt, so that we could be in line with the requirements from the IMF and from the ECB in the loan payments. Well, they didn't do it again. Now, take that one step further. Now we hear that Ireland, last week, is in need, potentially, of a bailout. And, of course, what did we hear? No such things. This is rhetoric. This is information that's bad. This is rumors that are unsubstantiated. And the Irish government poo-pooed the whole idea and said this isn't going to happen. But now we get to, all of a sudden, the 11th hour, and miraculously, Ireland needs not just a $10 billion, what they said, or 20, they need like $100 billion to bail out not only the banks, but to put some floor into the sovereign side of the equation so that they don't have to go to the markets at the extremely high prices to get funding, because they are funded through the middle of 2011. Now, all of a sudden, that is put aside. Let's take it one step further. Portugal. There's rumors circulating about Portugal. Of course, the Portuguese government says, no, we are not at all considering, nor have there been talks about, a bailout. Well, here we go with the boy who cried wolf. The markets didn't care. The markets said, you know what? We don't believe you. And they started to drag down the euro and drag down the Portuguese markets, bring up the CDS spreads and also the rates on the bonds. And there's a big question now of Spain. You see, as it goes, when you look at all these nations and the $1 trillion that was put aside to create a backstop fund and a bailout fund, if you will, it was really enough to take care of possibly what they thought at the time would be Greece and maybe Ireland, possibly Italy, maybe Portugal. Spain, on the other hand, is much too big with what they have going on. Their banks, their housing situation, and in fact, the housing situation is about to get a lot worse because a tremendous amount, this is just an article a couple of days ago, a tremendous amount of mortgage foreclosures and foreclosures on the market are going to start flooding the market over there so that banks can clean up their balance sheets. But backstep for a second and look at what happened. Immediately, even though Portugal is not, as they say, going to have a backstop or bailout, already Weber, ECB's Weber, said, you know what, if we need to increase the $1 trillion, we will. Well, everybody said, wait a second. We thought the $1 trillion was a shock and awe campaign that was way over the amount that was actually going to have to be used. And now you're telling us that you've bailed out two already, Portugal possibly next, even though they say they're not, and you're going to increase this number? Wait a second. That's not what we had in mind. We thought the whole idea was $1 trillion would be enough to take care of all the problems, and already we're starting to get beyond that 6 months later. So the idea that this confidence boost that was brought in by the $1 trillion is backfiring. The backfiring is because they've outright lied to investors. Now, also we're seeing that Germany's Merkel is looking to do some haircuts, saying that bondholders are going to have to take some risk in this deal. It's not only going to be to the wealthiest and the sovereigns. Germany is getting aggravated and fed up with having to carry these other countries. But unfortunately, Germany, you agreed to a single unified currency under the EU. And even though a lot of people said it was a bad idea at the time, and while it is an excellent idea to help with trade and to ease trade, I mean, much easier, right? One currency across borders. The problem is you have different and diverse economies, some dysfunctional and some that work. Germany's one that works. But you didn't do your due diligence, did you? And now you want everybody to pay for your errors. Not only Europe, but the entire ECB, Sarkozy, and the gang did not do the due diligence they were required to do, because if they did, they would have seen that Italy and Greece were coming into this deal with bad books, with books that they actually cooked. We know about this. To enter, showing that they were much better off and within limitations of the ECB doctrine when they created the EU single currency for allowance into the union. So there's where you have it. You have the rhetoric that can go so far, but once that rhetoric starts turning, just look what happened with bonds with Bernanke. How do you have inflation and at the same time have the need to bring down rates? In other words, if you're trying to increase inflation, which is one of the things that he targeted with the $600 billion QE2 payment. How do you actually go and in the same breath say we want to keep rates down, but we want to have inflationary trends? Inflation is higher rates. We know that. There's no mystery to that. So already we've seen another backfire in a move by the federal bankers or Federal Reserve or ministers of finance that are talking the talk, but not using the tools that they need to make the right things happen. As I've always said, austerity and growth cannot be in the same sentence. You can't have an austerity measure put on a country and expect them to have growth. It just doesn't work. So think about all the things that are going on. This is why we're short the euro. This is why we're short Europe, and it's been paying off handsomely lately. The euro is down dramatically over the last 3 weeks after it did very well to hit a high, and then the realization of, well, the outright, I can't say anything less than the lies. It's lies that were brought to the fore and hoping that things we could solve before anybody could find out really what's going on. And the European Union is absolutely embroiled in a total nest of lies that keeps on begetting, one lie begets another lie. So the confidence that we have for them, I think that investors have for them, is waning very quickly. And you're going to see the continuation of the problems there, even though Germany is clearly the center of good when it comes to their economy. We saw just last week that the business confidence is at an all-time high. Their exports are doing pretty well, and their country is doing very well when it comes to unemployment and overall consumer sentiment, etc., generally speaking, especially when you compare it to what else is going on inside the European Union. So I think that continues to be a theme that we need to look at. You know, it's sort of like if you want to go long the U.S., the economic numbers are looking much better of late. You can pick some excellent positions and do very well by going long either very specific positions or maybe even long the U.S. in general, S&P 500, whatever it may be. And at the same time, going short Europe. That arbitrage right there seems like a no-brainer. It really does. It seems like a no-brainer. But anyway, we digress on that. And lots of other things that we're going to probably talk about over the next few weeks when it comes to this particular subject, because unfortunately, it does not seem to be going away anytime soon. That's the case to be made for that. Also, I'll mention to you, of course, that if you have anything you want to tell me about that, maybe some people living in Europe, maybe some people living in the countries that I've mentioned, write in. Love to hear how things are going from your perspective and what you think of the austerity measures and what's happening with the euro. Just write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. All right, what else do we have to talk about? We're coming on the end of the year. The insider trading probe just got bigger and broader. That's going to be something to really look at. Goldman Sachs was brought into it again. Stevie Cohen, SAC, is being looked at as well. And we have about three or four other firms. We have also in India, which the country is very much we could call that a bit of an emotional trade. There was some insider scams and some things going on there that really are hurting their market right now. We sold our position in the India ETF about 2.5 weeks ago. We also sold the China, or Hong Kong, I should say, ETF about 2.5 weeks ago. And we also closed out our position in Taiwan. Right now, we are holding on the sidelines with emerging markets. As the markets turn, if they turn down, you'll see a lot greater harm done to the emerging markets. Usually it's about, 1.5 to 2 times more damage than you would in the U.S. And as the dollar continues to come up, and if we see a rally in the dollar, you're going to see some problems with that. And finally, let's talk to the other side. If we see things turn around, if we see the problems in Korea start to cool off a little bit, which I don't know if that's going to happen anytime soon, because North Korea is already getting very big mouth and very, very much their feathers in a ruffle about the U.S. doing some maneuvers or training exercises, as we call it now, better yet called posturing and a show of a stance. Well, China is now not happy with that, nor is North Korea. South Korea already said, you know what? You lob another bomb over this way and it's going to be an absolute fireworks display on your side. They're coming in strong. They're coming in very strong. The problem is that already strained relations that we're having now on the financial front when it comes to China is going to leak over onto this, because China has always been, if not a supporter, at least friendlier to North Korea in this whole entire episode. So we have that going on. We have commodity prices moving higher. We have protectionism all over the place. So it doesn't, right now, it's not setting up to be the best of all times, even though we see that Black Friday was actually pretty good when it came to the consumer. We'll have to get the final tallies next week. And we're seeing economics turn positive and corporate profits still being very reasonable in the U.S. But the problem is, I think this extra QE2 really put the straw that broke the camel's back when it comes to the rest of the world and how they view us right now, especially in the fact that we said that a strong dollar policy is great for us, but we're really pressing down hard on trying to weaken the dollar. So that's what it is. We're going to end the show right there, a little bit shorter than usual on this Thanksgiving Day weekend. I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you watched some great football, spent a little time with the family and friends, had some good turkey. I had turkey, but I had goose. You ever have goose? I had goose. It was a great, it almost tastes like duck, I guess. And it was a great holiday with the family. Looking forward to the end of the year and some things that go on. Kind of usually things kind of mellow out a little bit towards the end of the year. But you need to keep on your toes right now, because if in fact we see further insider information and insider trading scams and scandals being brought, you may see some hedge fund liquidations, especially when it comes to the end of the year, which is one of the quarters that a lot of them allow for withdrawals to happen. So I want you to keep on your toes of that and watch for very high volume, very sharp sell-offs. And maybe some of those are buying opportunities, but also at the same time, need to kind of step aside until the selling really starts to wear off. Then buy right in and right at the right price when it makes sense, when it starts to level off. Keep that in mind. And if you need anything from me, you know where to find me, over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you enjoyed John Malden, great guest. I'll see you soon. This is Andrew Horowitz on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Bye-bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.